So our lecture today is about decision-making, so decision-making and commitments. And honestly, there are already many books, many materials on this topic, so you can research it and you're going to find a lot of things about it. It seems to be a very human and timeless problem. It's not just nowadays. But, what made me more motivated to talk about it is especially this connection of decision-making with commitment. That, in my view, has been a challenge lately. Not in my view, but also in my life. It's been quite challenging. So I do have two emphases in this lecture. First, as I just said, the connection between choices and commitment. So is every choice a commitment? Well, not every choice have a big impact in our lives. We make, at least we think so, but even like small choices that we are taking repeatedly, they can shape our life. And we make hundreds of decisions every day. And one thing that I found as like almost a, I don't know if I can say that, but a universal truth, even from like Christian circles or secular circles, is that when we decide for one thing, we are leaving many other things behind, right? We are leaving many other possibilities behind, especially in the times we live today. And that is called the opportunity cost. So the loss of potential gain from other alternatives when one alternative is chosen. So every decision comes with a cost, the things we leave behind. Because even if it's for an hour, we have committed to this thing we have decided for, or you have committed today to come here, you are committing your time, your money, your energy, etc. And, is there something like non-commitment? Is that a thing? We can sometimes judge someone's behavior by saying they are not committed. They are not committed to a project, to a community, or something like that. But usually, it shows that this person is then committed to other things. So even if it's commitment to non-commitment, let's say a person wants to live a more like free life. And when I say, did I push play here? Yes, sorry. Just remembering. Let's say when a person wants to live a free life, like free in the sense of not having attachment from, from people, not attached to anywhere or anyone. Even if this person wants to live this non-attached life, this person is then probably committed to this idea or this concept of freedom. So it might sound as cliche, but when we simply don't choose, we are already choosing. When we don't commit, we are committing. Maybe committing to stay the same, but it's a commitment. And the second emphasis is to explore the waters we live in. So my background is in fashion and marketing. That's what I studied and worked for a big part of my life. So studying and analyzing trends in society and behavior have always kind of attracted me. And combined with that, one of the things that I learned here at Labrie is that many cultural movements or behaviors or trends, they point to some deep human yearning. So sometimes we can see the surface of these movements, and we can even like judge them as evil or sinful or something like that. But, well, they might be, but even so, when we go deeper into the roots of this set of behaviors, we might find something that points to the truth, to who we are as human beings, and realize that people might be finding the wrong answers to real, honest desires and questions. So, what we're going to do today, I'm inviting you for a dive. So we're going to start in the surface, where we'll go superficially through some movements we can observe around us or in our own lives. And going deeper in this dive, I hope to explore some of the causes of it. Why do we struggle to commit? Why is it hard to choose something? And by the time you feel you're drowning in hopelessness, I hope we can find a treasure, a biblical truth to anchor us and finish with some practical advices. So let's start with the surface. So as I just said, we initially just skim through some happenings, short stories, clips, and then we go further into the causes. And I'll start locally, and I hope no one gets mad at me if you have done that before. Okay, don't be offended. We are all in the same boat here. But one of the things that motivated me at first place to do this lecture is that we have been noticing how many people have been canceling their stays here at Labrie at the very last minute. And many don't even cancel. They just don't show up. Sorry if you've done that
That's
before. No, no, thank you. Yeah, you are here. You are showing up. Thank you. Well, and you might know we are not the most rigorous or formal with our bookings, right? We don't have a fine if you don't show up or something like that. So it can happen. It's okay. But the numbers have been increasing. And we have also heard of people that booked a stay at the same period of time in two or three branches of Labrie. So they were like keeping their options open until the very last minute. Well, and sometimes we see that, like to see if we are in the mood, you know, like it comes the day, oh, maybe if in the mood, I'll go, you know, or which Labrie am I in the mood to go, or something like that. Well, now you recognize yourselves, yeah, a little bit. Well, let me share with you just a bit of humor. So it might be exaggerated. And this one actually Rob shared with me.
Where are you? You're late.
Yeah.
Hey, yeah, I just woke up. I'm going to take a nap, but I don't think I'm going to be able to make it in today. The weather's just not giving.
What?
Yeah, just like the barometric pressure or something. It's like sending me. Wait, so why can't you come in? Oh my god, not you not understanding me. Basically, today's just not the vibe. The weather seems sus and I'm low-key anxious. So you can't come in because of your anxiety? Bet. Liliana, where are you? You're late.
Okay.
Hey, man.
Okay. Wow. That's good, isn't it? Well, so, but it's easy to mock other generations, right? Rob sending me, I'm not also Gen Z anymore, so it's easy to laugh at it, right? But for those of you who are millennials here, wait, because your turn will come also, okay? We're going to mock you also. Well, this short clip just points to maybe this kind of sacred place where feelings and inner dispositions have been placed that cannot be challenged and easily might become excuses for non-commitment. And we can also see how marketing is appealing to this as a benefit. So, for instance, the possibilities of returning a product. Some years ago, that was not an option. Now, with, of course, the popularity of online sales, most countries that I know regulate it so people have the benefit of returning a product within 1 or 2 weeks or even 100 days, like Zalando is doing. And not only if it didn't fit, but also if you just change your mind. So we bump into more marketing ads that include the benefit of being able to change your mind, like this from IKEA. Talking about changing your mind, something I heard on my research, marriage contracts with a due date. So 5, 10 years, that is called a beta marriage. So the vows of until death sets us apart might not be heard anymore in a near future. It is until our contract finishes. Well, then we, of course, will talk again and renew it if both parties are happy with the setting. Of course, with the renewal comes also a celebration, the renewals of vows party, and yeah, more products and more services to be sold. So the market is quite quick, right, to see new opportunities to make more money. And this is here, you see, millennials. This is your fault, our fault. I'm including myself. So this is popular among millennials. So not just only Gen Z have problems with commitment. It's also among our generation. So still on relationships. Have you heard the term situationship? Yeah, you have? I want to know who has heard it.
Oh, for sure.
Ooh, okay. Kind of half-half. Okay. I'm not gonna make the question who has ever been in one, okay? That we'll keep secret. So the Oxford Dictionary explains it like this. A romantic or sexual relationship that is not considered to be formal or established. The term became popular, especially around 2020, trending on Google searches, TikTok, and reflecting on an almost 50% increase of people's description on their relationship status on Tinder. That is, like, they are saying that or they were in a situationship or they were looking for a situationship. And another article from the BBC website explains that a situationship gives name to a hard-to-define stage of dating that experts say has skyrocketed in popularity among Gen Z. Right now, this solves some kind of need for sex, intimacy, companionship, whatever it is. But this does not have necessarily a long-term time horizon. So we can place some of the blame on social media and the impacts of the pandemic that has accelerated the already ongoing move towards online dating. During the pandemic, many singles saw the dating apps as the only way of getting to know new people, getting to know potential partners. And that really, I guess it was like that, right? It's not just an excuse, but it was the only way. But another article that I found from this mental health care institution describes the situationship according to these five categories. So first one, no labels or exclusivity. No clear boundaries, irregular or superficial contact, lack of integration into each other's lives, and the relationship doesn't grow or end. So it does seem like a recipe for anxiety, right? Do you want to get anxious? Follow these five topics. So, doing some Google search on the term and phenomenon, it's not hard to find the downside or the perils of it. Many websites are offering advices for people to see if they are in a situationship and how to get out of it, if that's what a person wants, of course. So even with some alarming information like this one from the Forbes website, most of the articles and content are simply stating that that's the way it is and we need to learn to navigate through it. So let's read what they say. Undefined, inconsistent relationships can be harmful due to their ability to make certain people question if the relationship itself is even real, as well as their partner's level of honesty and whether they might be involved with other people. This could also lead to feelings of abandonment, paranoia, and resentment towards people and relationship. Furthermore, this can impact self-esteem, social connection, and how people show emotions and connect with others. Not everyone can be resilient in these situations, and there could be long-term emotional effects. So, even with all the red flags that we hear here, what we most often read about it are phrases like this: if it works for you, if it feels right, or if it makes you happy, go on. And the solution they present is some like practical steps to recognize if it's unhealthy or not. I couldn't spend many hours going through all the results, but briefly on the first page on Google search, I couldn't find any article, anyone arguing the case for commitment and how commitment then could be maybe a better answer. And I guess that's not very popular then to talk about it. And of course, we know that on the first pages of Google, most content makers are worried to get a good ranking and see SEO and so far. But yeah, no one arguing that commitment might then be a better answer. That it's hard to find it. And some weeks ago, I also watched a video of some girls talking about dating and how much time the boys, which they were complaining about, were taking to get the conversation out of social media or out of WhatsApp. And one interesting remark I heard is that maybe this gratification system that takes place through these apps is replacing the true gratification of real in-person relationships. So the swipe culture and its mechanism has swallowed every area of our lives and trained us to expect quick, instant gratification. But we know that this instant gratification can be like a shot of caffeine instead of like a good night of rest and sleep when we need energy, or a quick medicine to numb our pain instead of a long life treatment. And there are even people now diagnosed with dating burnout. Yeah, that's real. Yeah. So, because you can add that to your list if you want. Because of the options you find online, all the options, all the conversations, all the situationships. But yeah, I've talked too much about the relationships area, so let's move on. There are still two areas that I want to touch in our assessment. And the first one is work. So not so long ago, I bumped into this article called The Disengagement Epidemic from a business magazine. It brings some data about turnover in companies. The research was made in Brazil in some companies classified as great places to work. So these companies are already kind of like above average than all the others. It says that in 2022, 43% of the employees of these companies were working there for less than 2 years. And the same or similar research conducted in 1997, the same number was 5%. So 95% of the people were working for more than 2 years. So, yeah, it seems to be a huge decrease on the number of people that stay long at the same company or job. Of course, this is not always bad. Nowadays, we have so much more access and opportunities, whereas maybe in the past, we just didn't have a choice. As Hank was telling yesterday night, right? You have three choices. You can work in your family company or your family company or your family company. Right? So, yeah, that was the past now. And maybe we were also stuck in some places or some kinds of work that was not the best for us or not the best place to develop, to grow. But we can ask ourselves if that has increased in the sense of fulfillment and satisfaction that we get from work. And some of the articles one can find about this disengagement are pointing to the opposite direction. A lack of hope, a lack of sense of purpose is probably the factors influencing this phenomenon. This specific article that we are reading here, Tell is calling the companies to work on their purposes and mission statements, helping the professionals to see how their role is important on the whole. And the same thing is pointed in this other article that has an interview with LinkedIn's chief economist, Karen Kimbrough. And they bring these three percentage there. So Gen Z workers are changing jobs 134% more than they did in 2019. Millennials are switching only 24% more. The company also found that 25% of Gen Z workers want to change jobs within the next 6 months. So of course, we have to remember that Gen Z is now the younger generation that is going in the market, right? So it is the time to explore, to change, to do internships and so on. But what they say in the article is that even when millennials were this age, the difference was much smaller. So there was not so much turnover as it is now. So they state that Gen Z is looking for flexibility on their work schedule and place, culture and purpose that matches their value. But what caught my attention was that Karen also says that the employers need to think about how they create mentorship and connection that will really keep Gen Zs in place. Which for me kind of connected with this other article from the Guardian that says like this. In 2022, the US employment site Indeed surveyed 1,000 18 to 41-year-olds about changing workplace attitudes. They found 82% of Gen Z respondents had never worked in an in-person office environment full-time. 92% say they are missing out on traditional workplace experiences, and 85% worried that they were disadvantaged in learning professional soft skills due to never working in a more traditional full-time role. So these two points in these two articles, they kind of like made me feel a bit more hopeful about the importance of the companies not only to work in their environment or how to be a purpose-driven company, but how people are realizing that in-person contact, that relationship, mentoring is important to develop skills, growth, and to produce engagement and commitment. But again, the same with the situationships or the relationships area. What caught my attention is the lack of material calling people to commit. Most articles are pointing to the external circumstances. So what is the company has to provide to do this work environment or provide mentoring or something like that. But not touching the personal level of commitment. So which seems kind of like hard or old-fashioned to talk about. And this is the last topic on our surface assessment, church hopping. So church hopping is not a new term. You might have heard that before, but it's still ongoing and accelerated through the pandemic. And I've mentioned this in another lecture of mine of how to choose a church, how we have been relating to everything around us as consumers. So also the church. Picking a church that serves me, mostly for my personal or spiritual growth, and while it serves me. So always leaving the exit door open or keeping my options open. These behaviors have had their impact on the membership numbers of churches, as I found in this article that I'm sharing here. So nearly 7 in 10 church boomers, 68%, versus 48% of church millennials and 51% of church Gen Z. Gen Z is better than millennials here. Confirming membership. Younger generations of churchgoers were also more likely to mention not applicable, which suggests that the category of membership isn't even part of their church nomenclature. So he also says that Americans, well, he's talking about the American context, but I'm sure it can, well, I think it can translate to our setting here, also in Europe. Americans aren't joining much of anything these days, and church membership is not as compelling as it once was. In a world of untethered commitments and free-for-all content, the positive correlations of church membership should not be overlooked. The form of membership may be undergoing change, but the function of generating a mutually committed group of people is still highly relevant to today's Americans and Europeans and Brazilians and so far. So, okay, that was the surface. I could spend the whole lecture just talking about it, but it's not the point, right? It's just the idea of us like to see what's going on around us and what influences us also in our behaviors and struggles. But now, let's dive a bit deeper and try to understand what's on the foundation of these movements. So I chose some of the causes that I see and try to bundle them like this. I'm sure there is more, so please bring them also in our conversation. So these three topics I'm going to also just... I'm not going to go in depth in them, but just show how they can be affecting our decision-making and commitment. So the first one, modernism, and the focus on the individual and its unfoldings. Okay. So modernism is a way of thinking which arose in modernity, a period of time roughly between the 17th and 18th century, with the Enlightenment, the era of reason. Richard Winter, in his book on perfectionism, this one, you're going to see me quoting it a bit today, puts it briefly like this. Modernism is the belief that with science, reason, and technology, we can make the world a better place. Our identity, from the modernist perspective, is defined by the objective scientific experts of genetics, anthropology, psychology, sociology, biology, and other sciences. Reality is what can be described and measured. In other words, modernism is rooted in human agency. The slogan, "Yes, we can," for example, is one that fits perfectly in this frame. The ideal of progress and freedom that comes through the advance of science also became the fertile ground for the advance of capitalism, an economic system that benefits from individualism. And individualism is a big aspect of modernism. So the modern individual is an autonomous self pushing away from constraints in order to maximize its possibilities. So the idea of expanding the amount of choices we have, it's in the heart of the modern man. The modern Western man thinks that there is no choice, there is no freedom. And, well, actually, God made human beings with choice. We are not programmed robots, right? We are given choices, and our choices matter. There are real consequences to it. But the assumption that comes just after that is where we can go really wrong, that the idea of more choices or more opportunities equal more freedom. That's what Barry Schwartz talked in his book this year. You're going to see many quotes from him today also. The Paradox of Choice. So in his book, Barry shows how our culture sanctifies freedom of choice so profoundly that the benefits of infinite options seem self-evident, even hard to question. We want everybody to have the same array of opportunities. And thinking that one doesn't get the same opportunities that another one messes with our modern beliefs and feelings of justice. But as he conducted his studies, he got more and more convinced of the perils of limitless choice and opportunities. Throughout the book, he shares studies that point to the unfortunate effects of this. It means that decisions require more effort, it makes mistakes more likely, it makes the psychological consequences of mistakes more severe. It may also lead to a lack of commitment, to procrastination, to a paralysis of choice. Not to mention the effects on anxiety levels, burnout, as we saw before, even dating burnout, and depression. And just a quick video also to illustrate it. I'm sorry, they are quite small. I hope you can watch it. So.
I'll spend an hour deciding on something to watch. By the time I choose something, I'm asleep. I feel like it's some big metaphor for my life.
And how does that make you feel about your mother?
Last week I asked for a raise. I got one. Now I'm anxious as hell. If I got that, I could have gotten more.
How does this object make you feel?
You know, at this point, better is not good enough. Good enough's not enough. Enough's not enough.
And what about this one?
I was on a date the other day. That was a disaster. I really liked her too, you know. I think she liked me. It's a good feeling to be liked. The trouble is, what's always the trouble these days? Alternatives. And the trouble is the whole time you're both thinking, I'm really connected with this person, but I also just matched with an athlete. If I go with this person now, I could be missing out on my soulmate. Because you think you can be with anyone, you wind up with no one. That's why it's so comforting to shop at Aldi's, no? One brand of chips. Take it or leave it.
Were you breastfed by your mother or your father as a child?
Didn't Sartre say that? That you weren't anxious that you could fall from a tall building, but that you could jump?
Maybe there's more value in committing to what you choose than choosing the perfect thing. I think you're suffering from the illusion of perfect, and the antidote to perfection is acceptance.
Oh, that's really good advice.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll ask my other therapist about that.
You have another therapist?
Yeah, she's Canadian, so.
But you said my advice was good.
Yeah, but it could be better.
That's great, isn't it? Yeah. The paradox of choice in a nutshell. Have you noticed the sock? Half in, half out. You cannot decide even to take out your sock or not. So I'll still quote Barry's book a couple more times in this lecture. He has some also good practical advices. But before we do that, let's think for a moment about freedom, choice, and limitations from a Christian perspective. So as creatures created in the image of an omnipotent and infinite God, we are called to be free and creative. But we are still creatures and finite beings. As God gave us choice and freedom, He also gave us boundaries. We are all bound by time. We age. We are bound by our physical bodies that cannot do 10 activities at the same time. We are bound by the culture we were born, the place or the abilities we hold, by space and time. If we think a minute about this, many times it's by the stretching of these boundaries that one gets in trouble. For instance, if we try to carry more weight than we should, we might get injured. Or if we try to schedule too many appointments in a day, we might have to race from one to the other and again get in trouble or get into an accident, for instance. So because we are finite beings, we need these boundaries. So this is maybe an old and very simple example, but I think it can like talk to everybody. I think it makes a point. The cartoon from the fish in the fishbowl that wants to get free from his free from the fishbowl or from the water to go outside. So he saw the fishbowl or the water as limiting his freedom, but it was exactly the boundary that gave him life, that gave him the possibility to thrive. Some limits, therefore, create the space where we can flourish and develop. Richard Winter says that we do not like being finite and limited. When things feel insecure and dangerous, we try to take control of our world. Sometimes we try to control other people's worlds as well. The problem at the heart of it all is that we cannot trust that God is in control. In reaction, we develop what Dennis Gibson calls a lust for omnipotence. This word is hard for me. The desire to be God. So, summarizing, the idea that we should get rid from all the limits and outside boundaries comes from this misconception that in order to develop, to grow, we need to have absolute control and that limits hold us back. While from a Christian perspective, we understand that God made us finite, and limitations can be a blessing also, in order to give us fertile ground to flourish as human beings. And here, we'll make a quick jump to the postmodern era. So, postmodernism and the focus on identity and the affections. Richard Winter also tells us in his book that just after the rise of the modern era, a reactionary movement started, a reaction against this mechanistic view of human nature. So in an attempt to preserve the significance and dignity of persons in a scientific age, these movements emphasized personal and subjective values to an extreme. The affections gained the higher stand. So without a reference point outside of ourselves in revelation, reason, or science, we are left only with subjective experience and freedom to choose to be whatever we want to be, to invent ourselves. For the big questions of life, such as, who am I? We are led to look inward, to find the answer in our inner worlds. The philosopher Charles Taylor talks about this inward movement that comes also with a search for authenticity. Maybe sometimes even a pressure for authenticity. It is as if we have this moral obligation to find out who we are and what our heart is saying, to follow our hearts. Now, in the midst of these movements, every choice and commitment you take end up being interpreted as an expression of who you are. Every little decision seems to have some influence on our identity. For example, you enter in this cool cafe in Utrecht, and you check the people around you, you check the menu and all the options, and instead of just having to pick the drink you want to drink, you're also thinking, what if I have this vegan V60 filtered coffee? What does it show about me? Or if I have this double espresso, what will people think about me? So, yeah, it seems silly, of course, a silly example, but we do it unconsciously. And of course, we don't ask that every time we order a coffee. But many times, one of the underlying motivations of our choices is, what does that represent about me? We hear sometimes that you are the sum of your choices. And that might seem real, because we face so many choices in this life that come with real and practical consequences. And also from this point, we can understand why it becomes so hard to commit to something, not only to choose, but to commit. Joel Barraclough, another Labrie worker from England, you met him, on his lecture about commitment, I recommend, he adds that the problem of maintaining fidelity is that we are not in control of the objects we are attached to. People change, places change, or institutions change. Again, the problem of control. We desire to have control in our hands. We are told we are the only ones that can shape our identities. So if any of these attachments we make goes wrong or different, it's our fault we made that choice and affects deeply who we are. Now, if we believe in a creator God, we also believe he created an identity for each one of us. And again, quoting Richard Winter, if there is a personal God who created us, then the heart of the issue is not what others or even we think of who we are. What really matters is what God thinks of us. We have a given or derived identity. Society does not define me. I do not define myself. God defines me. So the knowledge that I am created by God gives me a solid ground to say I do have a core identity, and none of my choices or commitments will alter that, can affect that. And also, that I am created in his image with freedom and creativity should liberate us to use the space he gives us to develop our personalities through our choices. And we can trust his faithfulness. His love and mercy won't get any tiny bit smaller because of any bad decisions we make. Now, next one. COVID-19. So, there's a lot to talk about trust and fear and how all this pandemic affected our relationships with these two aspects. So these two are very important factors in decision making. So they influence our decisions a lot. And I would like to address it while we explore this third movement, the COVID-19 pandemic. We cannot ignore some consequences this past couple of years have had on our abilities to choose and commit. And I have to say, this is a very recent topic, so most of what I'm sharing here, it's my observations, okay, or my experiences. I think probably in a couple of years, we'll hear more scientific researches and solid data about it. But here, it's me, okay, it's Mika, so you can also bring your experiences in the end. Well, there is an almost obvious increase in the feeling of fear during the pandemic related to the virus itself. Fear of the unknown, fear of getting sick, fear of death, fear of the contamination or spreading it further. At moments, there was little substantial information about it, most of it speculation. At other times, there was so much information that came with discussion, division, or suspicion. So the fear that came with the disease only got bigger as all this information flooded through our screens, conversations, and social circles. And yeah, this is a bit of a Brazilian example. I don't know if it will relate to you here, but the president of our country says one thing, then the health ministry says another thing, then your general practitioner talks about this possible treatment and vitamin that will prevent it. And your neighbor then talks about other treatment and so on. So it seems such a confusion of different information. and the outcome, less trust. So we trust less in the government. We trust less in institutions. We trust less in our doctors and even in our family members. These two charts that I'm going to show next, they show this decrease in trust. Again, it's an American research, a Gallup poll from 2022. Yeah. And it shows the decrease in trust in the media and also in the government through the years. So we can also add here this increased fear of the future. At the beginning of the pandemic in Brazil, I'm going to tell my personal story now. I was still there in Brazil and working in this shoe company. I worked with shoes for many years. And I think it was around March or April, we were told to stay at home for a couple of weeks. And then later, I don't know, 2 weeks or three, some of us got summoned back to the office. Like, come on, like, take this for the team. So there we were. And the office there is all made of glass, all the walls, the divisions or the departments. So there was I, back to the office, not exactly knowing how to restart or what part of my work would really make a difference at that crazy moment. And this was me. Yeah, wearing a face mask and a face shield. That was the requirement of the company to be there. But a small detail, I was alone in my fishbowl. There was no one else like with me in this space, me and my computer. And yeah, as I looked around and other half dozen people scattered around the office with the same costume that I had, I remember thinking, is this really happening? Is this real? Because I feel like in a Black Mirror episode, this cannot be real. Well, so when something you have never imagined to go through happens in real life, we get to wonder, what else? Our train of thought quickly brings us to pessimistic thoughts about the future, a more complex world. And to make it worse, we also witnessed a peak in polarization. It felt as if we were not allowed to have an opinion or to pick a side. We had to pick a side. Either you were all in or all out. Once more, as we were talking about the postmodern times, our choices seem to have a big weight on our identity. So if you choose to stay home, you are this and you belong to this group. If you choose to get out, you are this and you belong to this other group. And lastly, I'm being very negative about the pandemic, okay? I know there's many maybe good side effects of it, but my point today is to point the negative. Lastly, after the worst of the pandemic was gone, how many people returned to church or other groups, commitments? How many friends that you saw in a regular basis you continue to see? Again, an unfortunate consequence is that many of our old commitments simply didn't come back. We quietly slided off them. And personally, I think the worst is that many people in these settings didn't feel missed. So we were all so slow to, let's say, get back with our social lives, and of course with legitimate reasons for that many connections were lost. So lost connections, lost commitments. And so, in my opinion, the concept of commitment has lost a bit of its strength also. Okay, so I told you you were going to drown in hopelessness, a lot of bad news and happenings, but let's move on. So far we have seen that probably some of the struggles we find to choose and commit come from these three movement and related ideas. Modernism and the limitless idea of freedom, the focus on the individual, the postmodern movement to inward truth, and the burden on crafting our own identities. And some developments of the pandemic, as increased fear and the breaking of trust and prior bonds. And now, for the third part of this lecture, we are going to go through some concepts and practical ideas to help us in decision-making and commitment. To do that, I thought that better now than later to see what's the concept of commitment. What is commitment and why am I claiming it's a good thing? So let's do that. Yeah. I'm going to use here the definition that Joe Barrichello, the other Labrie worker that I quoted before, has in his lecture. Commitment is a choice to bind yourself to something for a purpose. It's deciding to be in a particular place, doing particular work with particular people, in line with some particular way of understanding what is good and what is not. So the word particular here implies that choice is necessary, that limits are necessary. You cannot bind yourself to everything, to everyone or every place. It's particular, again, because we are finite beings. I also like here that he added the word purpose and the way of understanding what is good and what is not. So learning to commit might start by a bit of study and some self-awareness. What do I truly believe? I am always very excited here at Labrie when we receive people that come with questions about their faith, but that came to the conclusion that they cannot make any decisions, like further decisions, without before working through these questions, because they are so fundamental and they affect all other areas of life. How I see the world, who God is, who I am in His image, makes all the difference in the decisions and commitments we take in these different areas. Commitment also means that some decisions are made in advance, and we follow these decisions, we stick to them. It requires hope. So, Joe says that the only reason people really commit to something is because they see some potential good ahead. Maybe in the Bible, the language for it is more often addressed as promises, or especially from God to us, and also the word covenant. We read in the Bible how God is committed to His people since day one. From all of Israel's wanderings and fallings out, God is always by their side. In Joshua 21:45, we read, "Not one of all the Lord's good promises to Israel failed. Every one was fulfilled." And in Deuteronomy 7, "Know therefore that the Lord your God is God. He is the faithful God, keeping His covenant of love to 1,000 generations of those who love Him and keep His commandments." So from Genesis to Revelation, God keeps His promises. He keeps His covenant. And what caught my attention reading throughout the Bible about His promises, about His commitment, is that it is repeated over and over. It's repeated so His people and we will remember it. God also puts signs like the rainbow in the sky after the flood as a sign of the covenant. And He also renews His covenant, as we read here in Jeremiah. "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah." So that makes me reflect on the commitments we make in our lives. Commitment isn't just something static or held in the past. Marriage, for instance, it doesn't stand only by the promise made in the altar. Every day we need to remember our promise and think of what does it mean for the moment I live now. We need to work from it. We need to give signs to our beloved that we are faithful to our commitments, and sometimes even renew it. And this leads me to our next question. So why is commitment good? So, as I just said before, first and foremost, as a Christian, I would say that is because that is the way the Lord made us and the way He relates to us. He made us to live in relationship with Him, with each other, and in this world, with creation. And relationship requires commitment. Even Barry Schwartz, in the book The Paradox of Choice, comes with this conclusion when he talks about, I'm going to quote him now, "The modern emphasis on individual autonomy and control may be neutralizing a crucial vaccine against depression, deep commitment, and belonging to social groups and institutions." So from his perspective, he's also calling people to embrace some kinds of constraints because they actually bring some kind of liberation and fruitfulness. And in a very practical level, I think we can all agree here that it's only when we commit to practice something that we improve, that we get better at this thing. An instrument, a sport, a craft, so on. Practice, repetition, consistency is the way to learn, to get better at something, to grow. Our commitments also help us not to wander around, to float without roots. They root us. Looking at nature, for instance, a plant won't grow without the roots, right? You cut the roots, they die. In a world where everything is possible, they help us to stay in reality, to make decisions even. They can lift the pressure of some decisions and the famous fear of missing out. When you know what is the purpose of your commitments, the purpose that binds you to a place, a person, or a job, for instance, it gets easier to say no to all the other options. Commitment is also totally necessary for the functioning of our society. So, for instance, if the bus driver doesn't show up in time, we won't get in time for our appointments. Or now, I guess, Krista is committed to make a good lunch for us while we are here. And I really like the passage on the Bible in Jeremiah 29, where God calls the Israelites to work in Babylon, where they were exiled. He says, build houses and settle down, plant gardens. So they are called to commit to this place, even though it's not their home, it's not their promised land yet. And now, the third question, or fourth, I lost count already, but yeah, how do we get it? Are there ways through which we can get better in decision-making and committing to them? And I think we can have a hopeful answer here, hopeful yes, there are ways. And I will go through some advices I found, some more theoretical and some a bit more practical, on five topics. So, the first one, I already talked a bit about it, so I'm not going to extend too much. Knowing your values and purpose. Knowing what you believe, what you treasure, your priorities, your purpose. For instance, my main purpose in life is to give glory to God. But how I, Mika, in my uniqueness, do that in the unique ways God created me is how I think about my personal purpose. That goes from accepting some limitations. For example, I am not a good musician. So that's not going to be the way I'm going to give glory to God, definitely. But I believe he calls me to commit in the development of the gifts he gave me. Two, community. There's a lecture I like to listen from time to time, maybe as a reminder of something. It's called Community as a Subversion of Modernity from Andrew Fellows. He talks about modernity as our Babylon, and we are called to change it from the inside, as the verse in Jeremiah that I just quoted, and from outside. And because individualism is in the center of modernism, he says the greatest challenge of modernism is intentional community, is the extreme opposite of individualism, to invest in intentional community. The economist and historian Albert Hirschman, in his book Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, suggested that people have two general classes of responses when they are unhappy or dissatisfied. So, they can exit the situation or they can protest and give voice to their concerns. In the marketplace, exit is the characteristic response to dissatisfaction. So, when we are not satisfied, let's say, with our internet provider, we move on. We choose the next one that will give us a better service. And that's the normal way to relate to the market. Now, if we want to swim against this current that has made us relate to every aspect of life as consumers, when we face dissatisfaction in a relationship, in a church, we shouldn't run to the exit door, not right away. Look for the next possibilities. But first, because we hope and believe in the long-term benefits of commitment, we'll try to work it out, to put effort, to talk or forgive. And connecting to what we said before, commitment is good because it's the path for growth and development. It is in the context of healthy, committed relationships, family, friends, church, that we find both a place to belong, to be loved and appreciated, and a place to be accountable. An important distinction here is what does commitment to a community looks like. And I imagine the first thing that comes to many of my mind or your minds also is connected to activities or tasks and programs. That's the way we commit. And I've heard some weeks ago, someone that was afraid of committing to his church because of the expectations the church would put on him. So he was afraid of committing because he was, thinking that people would feel he was not committed because they had other expectations, that he would take part in everything, in every activity and so on. So we have to be, we have to realize that, of course, for a church to work, we need people that are engaged, that take responsibilities. But also we have to be very careful not to become task-oriented churches or communities. God has called us to live as a body for us to grow in relationship with Christ and one another, for us to flourish as human beings, as we read in Colossians. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Bear with each other and forgive one another. If any of you has a grievance against someone, forgive as the Lord forgave you. And over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. Yeah. I also found it interesting reading Schwartz about the benefits of being in stable, trustworthy social relationships when it comes to make decisions. He says, as long as we include social interactions in our information gathering, as long as our sources of information are diverse, we can probably steer clear of the worst pitfalls or the worst decisions. So living in community gives us outside perspectives that help us navigate in decision-making. Now, the next topic, reality and perfectionism. So to be rooted in reality has two sides. One side is to accept that we live in a broken world, that we are limited, that we will fail many times, and that our range of control is very limited. The other side is also realizing, as the verse in Colossians we just read says, we are already dearly loved. It's not our choice for university that will change God's love for me. Even my repeated failures, they won't change God's promises that he will be at my side and he will walk with me. So this reality for me, it's so life-giving. It's so freeing. It frees us to try. God gave us choice, gave us creativity. And I think he delights in seeing his children making use of it. Richard Winter also says that we resist trial and error learning, which happens to be one of God's favorite ways to teach us wisdom. In order to get on with life, we must take a stand, letting go of some of the alternatives available to us. He also says that the drive for perfection is a drive for control. In our attempts to avoid emotions such as shame, guilt, or disappointment, we try to control every aspect of life, to curate it. But accepting and learning how to navigate these emotions is an important part of real life. Now, in a practical way, Barry Schwartz, throughout his book, he uses these two categories for people, the maximizers and the satisficers. So maximizers are those who want to ensure they get the most out of their choices, the best. They tend to have an all-or-nothing mindset. And satisficers are those who tend to adopt a mindset of, this is good enough. And, of course, we are not always one or the other. In some seasons of life, or even some areas, we are maximizers, and in others, we are satisficers. But one of his biggest points is that even when the maximizers get the best outcome of their decisions or the best objective result of their choices, they most likely have a worse subjective outcome. Or putting in other words, they are less satisfied, they are unhappy about it. So in practice, think about your priorities and the areas where good enough is actually better than the best. Where the paralysis of choice or the restless search for the best is robbing your joy. If you have a list of possibilities from which to choose, I would say first, what are the real possibilities? You can think, if I chose to marry this girl, then all the other options are closed. Yes, they are, but come on, are there really so many options? someone that likes you, that is by your side, that you trust, and yeah, come on. a list of possible matches from Tinder, it's not a real list. It's not real possibilities. Barry also says that the existence of multiple alternatives makes it easy for us to imagine alternatives that don't exist. Alternatives that combine the attractive features of the ones that do exist. So, for instance, I like the nature from Eckenville. I like to live in Eckenville. But I would like to have it combined with the possibilities of food delivery from Utrecht. You know? But that's just not real. I have to pick what's the priority for me. Or the real possibilities to live in one place or the other. So, if you have a list of possibilities, stick to the top. If you are in the city center looking for a place to eat, for instance, I don't know for you, but I get nervous when I have to choose something to eat in so many possibilities. Stick to the block that you are. Don't go further. Resist the temptation of checking what's the next restaurant and the next one. Resist the temptation of adding more options to your list. It will only add the anticipated regret of a choice. Now, wow, sorry, I forgot to pass it. Okay, 4, habits and consistency. We already talked about how committing to something is the way to get better at this thing. It's by repetition and consistency that we develop and improve. And in this direction, I like this advice from Barry, choose when to choose. He says that keeping some habits or routines in our lives keeps us from the tyranny of small choices. So if you decide, if you made a routine, for instance, of waking up every morning and making 30 minutes of exercise, that is set. You don't need to decide it every morning or, waking up and thinking, should I do it or maybe I can stay a bit more in bed. He also says that sometimes to follow rules or standards also frees us. So if you suffer, for instance, from the desire of being everywhere at the same time and is burning yourself out as an outcome, make a rule of keeping one social or cultural appointment per weekend. And the idea of freeing us from these small choices, these daily small choices, is so that we can have more energy and time to focus on what's really important, on real important choices, or areas that we really want the best, and we can go after the best in some areas. So the right motivations also make a big difference on your ability to be consistent, to keep doing, to commit. The easiest example, again, is with physical activities. So if you are exercising in order to get thin, to be thin, that's hard. In most cases, that's a long-term outcome. That's not one day to the other. You won't get out of the gym every day and say, yes, I am thinner, I feel thinner. It doesn't happen like that. So, but if you have the motivation to be healthier or the motivation to live a more active life, then you can get out of the gym and say, I am healthier, I am more active. That's a more positive motivation. A general rule of thumb is to differ from negative and positive motivations. Do you want to commit to this work you do because you are afraid of losing it? Or you want to commit because you know you can serve your clients or your colleagues better? These are different motivations. Another advice could also be to make a plan. When it's hard to commit, even when you know all the good things about commitment, it's usually not a key in your mind that just turns on, like, now I'm going to be committed. No, it also takes time and practice. And a plan to keep going might be important. So, for instance, if you want to be more committed to your church, you have to plan how are you going to do it. Is it by setting a rule of going every Sunday in church? Or is it by adding daily prayer for your community, 5 minutes a day? Or whatever, you can pick your, make your plan, what serves you. Another general idea about plans. Big goals need to be broken into smaller goals, more attainable in daily life, that will build up like little blocks until we reach the big goal. Last one, contentment and gratitude. When we read about the struggle to make choices, one big aspect is comparison. And following the logic of the paradox of choice, when we had less options, we had less to compare to. Now, when there are too many options, the chances increase that there is a really good one out there, and you feel that you ought to be able to find it. Our fertile imaginations are something beautiful and good, but as everything in this broken world, sometimes they also work against us. We keep imagining, what if? What if I had chosen that other path? What if I hadn't made that investment? What if I was more similar to that person? And I guess we can all here easily agree that that's not a good way to go, right? We know with our minds that to think about what if won't change the past, the future, and will rob us from our satisfaction and joy from what we have now. But how do we stop it? How do we stop these thoughts? Well, the Bible tells us to take all our thoughts captive to Christ. So pray, tell the Lord what's going on in your mind. Ask for His help. Start by telling all the things you are grateful for. Gratitude is powerful, and it is a virtue we can practice. We can get better at it by repetition. Paul tells us that endurance produces perseverance, and that produces character, that produces hope. So it might seem a long way, and maybe it is a long journey. But at the end, hope is a medicine against all these comparisons and useless rumination. Because we trust in the Lord, we know and hope that He uses everything for good. So what is the opposite of rumination? Could it be contentment? And that's a tricky word nowadays. We confuse it with complacency. So let's make it clear the difference of these two words. Contentment is the state of being satisfied, experiencing joy and gratitude in the present situation, while still knowing things can improve, that you can strive to achieve other goals, to get better at some things. While complacency refers more to a satisfaction without joy, even without gratitude, is shrugging your shoulders and not being active to change something when clearly there's improvement at hand. In 1 Timothy, we hear, now there is great gain in godliness with contentment. For we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of this world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we'll be content. So I feel there's so much always for us to be content and grateful for. And to be content and practice gratitude is a key to follow the commandment of not coveting, for instance. It is also clear how this is key for commitment. If we start any commitment with the mindset of, let's see if it goes right, or I'll keep my other options open, according to some studies, that's even a recipe for failure. So I studied published from the Institute of Family Studies shares that among a sample of 1,600 Americans who were married for the first time between 2010 and 2019, 34% of marriages ended among those who had lived together before being engaged, while just 23% of marriages ended among couples who waited until after engagement or marriage to move in together. Also, Barry talks about the difference it makes when we decide and commit versus when we decide and still live with our options open. So when we can change our minds about decisions, we are less satisfied with them. When a decision is final, we engage in a variety of psychological processes that enhance our feelings about the choice we made relative to the alternatives. I like to call this as closing the tabs, because that's literally a problem for me. If you see, my internet browser has like 50 tabs open. I just cannot close them. So the idea is that when something is decided, you got to close the other tabs and focus on what you have decided. Because that those other tabs there, they might keep you constantly second guessing your decision and work against your focus. There is a simple, in theory, formula to calculate the investments we make in every decision process. In one side, we have the costs. There is the opportunity cost that we talked before. So the cost of leaving behind the other options that, as we said before, will only increase as long as we keep adding other things to the list. And there is the cost of effort, of time you put in the process of decision making. And the other side is your gains. The gain can be objective and subjective. So objectively, you can, at the end, have chosen the best car in the market with a very good deal. Subjectively, however, you can be less satisfied with your choice because, or you spend too much time in this pursuit and left important things behind, or because it made you stress too much, or because by checking more and more possibilities, you just cannot stop thinking that there must be a next one, another better deal. And by showing you this formula, I don't want to say that the secret is to keep your costs low. That's not the secret. Because it depends on each decision and situation. Is the decision you're making going to have short-term or long-term effect? That will different. With long-term, makes more sense to spend more time and effort. But with short-term, possibilities are also that it's something more reversible or that you can deal with your minor consequences later. So, this is it.